Hello and welcome to The Front Page, the show from The Racing Post that gives you everything you need to know about what's happening in racing. It's all killer, no filler, and so we dive straight in to the weekend's biggest story, which of course is the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe. Delighted to be joined in the studio by Peter Scargill and Lewis Porteous to discuss the Arc and all the other big news from the last week or so. Well, none of us, alas, were in Paris. Pete, you did eat a lot of cheese to get in the mood. Well done. Had like some wine, we're practically French. But what did we think of the winner? Darius, beating Mini Hawk in a thrilling finish, just overhauling in the shadow of the post to give the Aga Khan colours an eighth victory in the race. But was he a great winner?
Oh, is it, can I slightly edge away from that and say it's too early to say whether he's a great winner? He only ran yesterday. In the context of time, we will know. But he beat the right horse in Mini Hawk, didn't he? You know, going into the race with a three arc wins.
It's got the right look to it. They went clear of the rest, did they?
Precisely, yes, precisely. Indeed. And you know, you've got Sozie in third for Fab, and Giovolotto, who ran a great race in
storming
fourth
race,
well.
Considering Giovolotto was supposed to hate the ground.
Hate the ground, was going nowhere to begin with. They rolled the dice, and they did. I know Lewis did a good piece earlier in the week with Marco Botti about it, bringing over Andrea Rezzoni to ride. So I don't know whether he's a great winner because, I mean, there's still so much we don't know about the horse. He only debuted this year, didn't he? It's sort of Ace Impact-esque in terms of how he's progressed from nothing to an Arc winner by the end of the year. But when you look at the context around him and the way he won and his breeding and the fact he's by the best horse that ever existed and See the Stars, then, you know, there's a lot there to think that he will do. And as far as I'm aware, is he carrying on next year, isn't he? There's no suggestion he's retiring.
I don't think we know yet, but let's hope so, certainly.
Yes. Where's the camera? Keep him in training next year.
He has the potential to be great, doesn't he? I think that's what it is. If they did keep him in training, to have come so far in such a short space of time, he certainly has the potential to be great. Yeah.
Although, as per Ace Impact, you know, we hope that the winner gets a chance to actually show that. Mini Hawk, though, of course, ran a storming race. Christophe Soumignon pulled the trigger quite early. Johnny Murto on ITV did say maybe he went half a furlong too early. Classic example of how thin the margins are in top-class sport. Do we think Mini Hawk, in another running, potentially comes out on top? This tactic's been slightly different?
I have to say, watching the race live, it wasn't my instinct that he'd gone too soon. I thought he was on a horse that... All we know is that she grinds it out, she stays, she's a strong stayer. So what, you're not going to sit there and wait for something maybe to out-sprint you. I think he played to his horse's strength. He kicked early, and you've got to see the space back to Sozie in third. It was a gaping gap. He ran the finish out of all of them bar one, who was, like we just said, is going to hopefully turn out to be an exceptional racehorse. So I wouldn't be critical. I thought he played to Mini Hawk's strengths personally. I thought she ran an absolute cracker.
And Murta's right in the sense that if you get beat, and particularly if you get run down, and if you've been on the favourite, you probably go back and go, if I had the chance again, might I do this differently? That's why these are top-class sportsmen.
Yep.
This is why they've achieved what they've done as riders, in Murta's case as a trainer as well. But it's not like Soumignon had a bad day, is it?
Well, it's an interesting dynamic,
like
isn't it?
Oh, it's another one that Soumignon.
He was having
up.
An unbelievable day. Confidence was obviously sky high. Maybe that actually informed his decision to really punch her home and see what happens.
Exactly. So you're riding the favourite. You're riding a horse that's probably cruising along. You think, oh, I'm going to win another Arc here. I don't think you can say he did anything wrong. But in the sense of self-analysis. Or analysis by top-class sportsmen, you can see why Murta might have come around to that opinion.
Soumignon seemed pretty content with the ride he'd given it. I'm sure that would have been the tactics talked about. She isn't a quick. She's a lengthener, isn't she? She's not a quickener. So,
and she probably didn't really love the ground either. Another one that would have probably preferred a slightly firmer surface.
Yeah, you think so? But like you say, with Giovolotto running that race, it's hard to know.
Incredible.
And I tell you what, would have been interesting if Daraz hadn't gone past, because they come a long way across, didn't they, to the left? I just wondered if that would have been maybe a contentious one in the stewards' room. I don't know why Mini Hawk was sort of drifting to her left the whole way. Anyway, we're not there.
Well, let's talk about a few further back in the field. Byzantine Dream for the Japanese contingent ran an absolute stormer of a race. Incredible clip shown as well on the TV stream of thousands of fans at Tokyo Racecourse, got on 11 p.m. waiting up at the track to watch that. I mean, what a fantastic testament to the passions of Japanese racing fans. Horses run an absolute stormer from a wide draw, but the chips just don't go the way of the Japanese and the Arc so far.
No, it seemed to be going so well. Scott Burson, our France correspondent, has been cataloguing it for the last few weeks. They all won their trial races. Yep. I think it's the first time that's happened, isn't it? Three contenders, horses like Quaidanon, who've been laid out for this race months in advance to bring their, then, you know, the week of the Arc, the forecast changes, a buckets down with rain, and then just sort of add the irony. There was actually a shower during the race.
Exactly.
You know, to add insult to injury. And then, at draw time, they've got what turned out to be the, you know, effectively two of the three widest stalls, even. So Byzantine Dream, who had a better draw, ran a good race, faded a little bit at the end. Mm. You know, the Arc's never going to be an easy race to win. But yeah, you must be, those people who've been stayed up late to watch this race must be thinking, this again.
I did wonder what happens after the race for those 10,000 people at Tokyo Racecourse. I mean,
riot, wreck the place, breaking baguettes, throwing things over.
Absolutely. That's channeling the best of. French sporting celebrations. Yeah, Kalpana flew the flag for Britain. Another fairly small British challenge. Obviously, Giovalotta ran fantastically well, but Kalpana was the flag bearer going into it. Tough, probably upgrade the form there, having had a pretty circuitous route.
She had a tough trip. She tried to go forward, got stuck out on the wing, finished seventh. In the circumstances, I thought it was a perfectly decent run, but without ever really looking like she was going to threaten. The draw is a big angle to this. The first three are in the boxes 1, 2, and 3. It's interesting because earlier in the week there was a press conference with Christoph Furland, who trainer of Aventure, a digital sort of press conference, and I did ask a question like, who's your biggest danger? And he said, rather than any horses, the thing that will decide this race is what stalls these horses get, and it does have a major impact there, which I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but it's just a huge, huge factor in a mile and a half round longchamp.
Yeah.
And because you have to pay to come out the race, you don't get on run a bad draw.
Yeah, of course. Is it 1%?
Yeah. 1%. If it's not a vet certificate, because it's the Kinte.
So 50,000 odd euros to be an on runner. Mm-hmm. Well, that'll do it. Mm-hmm. It worked out well for Giovalotto, though, didn't it? They probably wouldn't have run.
Exactly. They were in the positive.
A very good net swing. We don't have time to go through exhaustively the entire undercard.
There's experts to do that elsewhere.
There's experts in the Racing Post to do that. But we have to say a word for Asfura, who won the Abbe. First of all, kudos to the Henry Dwyer camp, who have just campaigned this horse with great daring and enthusiasm and had a wonderful time as a result. But so almost a complete disaster in that they brought the wrong passport to the racecourse and had a 200 euro Uber screaming across central Paris to get it there in time. Got there about a minute and a half before the cutoff.
Wow. Yeah, remarkable. Remarkable subplot to the story. But I mean, I would only echo what you said. It's been a pleasure to have an international campaigner over here this summer, and to be campaigned so openly. They've gone for everything pretty much. They've run their race. Henry Dwyer has been very accessible. You've probably spoken to him more than I have.
Fantastic, to deal with.
Fair play to them. They've come back with two Group Ones. It's not the strongest sprinting division up here, as we know. Fair play to them.
Say kudos to the sort of stewards on the day as well. They gave him every chance to get that passport there. Yeah. He was in the pre-parade, and without this passport, they let the jockey way out and all that sort of thing. Like, I just can't really have seen that happening over here. Going that down to the wire. I thought it was great that they gave it every chance. There was nothing, bad about the situation. It was just unfortunate. Let's give him every chance to get this passport to the race course, and fair play for holding on, because she brought a lot to the day. Mm-hmm.
Certainly did. Fair play to everyone in Paris. It was a fantastic couple of days of racing. Just one final word for ITV, because we got the news that ITV are extending their deal with racing through to 2030. Fantastic that they cover the action in Paris. But I'm going to say something. This is a challenge to ITV. Get the team out there. Get the team out there. You know, Ollie Bell did a great job on his own, but the rest of them are presenting from Ascot, an empty race course. You know, it's one of the great days of European racing.
I completely agree, yeah. First of all, great they cover it. Great this the contract's been extended. This is all positive for British racing. Like I say, Ollie Roven reporter, great job, but it just sucks a little bit of the feeling of the
cut
day.
Cut back to empty,
yeah,
Ascot.
Yeah, exactly. But there'll be all sorts of reasons
they're
for
they're piling
it.
On more layers every time they come back. Okay, we will leave the Arc de Triomphe there, but as you say, the comprehensive reaction and analysis on Racing Post platforms. We're going to move, though, to the home of flat racing, Newmarket, because it's Tats Book 1 this week, begins Tuesday, and this is one of the great set-piece moments of the world flat calendar, mm-hmm. where the biggest superpowers and flat racing go head-to-head, fortunes are made, blue bloods are purchased and sold, some of whom will go on to glory, others to quite the opposite. Peter, what should we be watching out for? You, of course, know quite a lot about the sales, perhaps not in the rarefied heights of Book 1, but you're certainly no stranger to the sales ring. So tell us what we should be looking for over the next few days.
Well, you're right to build it up that way. Because it is a theatre, and it is a parade of incredibly well-bred, desirable, embryonic racehorses that everyone's hoping that, like you say, in 12 months' time they'll be talking about the champion two-year-old. And well, so it's the start almost of the following season's narrative, to use a unpleasant term, in that sense. So you know you're going to have all the big boys there, all throwing cash about and all saying, we're making a mark here and you need to pay attention to us. Now, nobody drew more attention to themselves last year than Keirdre Abdon and his Amo Racing operation. Whether or not they will play so spectacularly this year, it's not entirely certain. Obviously, they're not going to have the element of surprise this time around. Keir has spoken about how they've adapted their strategy a little bit this year, so they're not just focusing on Book 1, they've bought a car.
Yeah, they really stunned people last year with the scale.
It came from nowhere in the scale, and the braggadocio, the fact that they were there overtly doing it, they were spending huge sums of money, they bought, you know, the top price horses far beyond what they'd done previously. So I don't know whether there's that, you're going to have that level of surprise going on, but there will be huge sums of money exchanged.
So the key players, of course, Godolphin and
Sheikh Mohammed. Yeah,
Sheikh Mohammed normally is an attendee at these
exactly.
sales.
Exactly, it's one of the very few times he's present publicly in Britain these days. Yeah,
yeah. Absolutely. Coolmore, of course.
Ammo,
increasingly. Who
Definitely.
Else should people be watching out for?
Well, it seems, you know, whether or not they're going to be leading buyers, I don't know. There's been a lot of American interests at the sales this year. Before I came on here, there's no point having good contacts and excellent resources if you don't pull on them. So I spoke to James Thomas and Ashton Crowe from the Bloodstock Department to help inform my view. Obviously, James is on the
contacts,
ground.
Contacts, colleagues, potato, potato.
Precisely. James is obviously on the ground for all of the sales, and Ashton knows the stuff. And they both talked about the American influence, obviously, President Trump with his tax breaks, his one big beautiful bill, which I think has been changed.
What's
since.
He done? What's the tax break?
He's made it possible for you basically to write off the cost of the racehorse.
100% tax deductible.
As far as I'm aware, yeah. From reading the Bloodhorse.
Wow.
Which has obviously fired up the market, particularly in America.
It would do, wouldn't it?
Been,
yeah.
And it's been crazy, the level of exchange going on in America, and that has spilled over. John
probably
Stewart.
Not one we'll see Rachel Reeves doing in the 20s.
I wouldn't have thought so. No. She's very much looking to get tax in rather than giving tax breaks.
Yeah.
People like John Stewart was a Resolute Racing, a big Eurofine in terms of his racing interests.
Yeah.
He was very present at Goff's. I'm sure he'll be about. He bought big at the December sale last year, so I think American interest will be there. And the only other one, and I want to again pull on these guys' knowledge base, was that before Arcala, the big Arcana August sale, which Amwell bought the top lot for, there was rumours and suggestions that Sheikh Mansour, the Man City owner, was going to, with his Wahba Stallions brand, was going to get in. Obviously, he bought the big stud in France over the winter. Now, that didn't emerge at Arcana, but if there was a sale that he and his operation might dip their toe into, if they're going that way, it would be Book One. Now, whether or not it transpires, I don't know, but he may be the dark horse, if there is one, to come on the scene. It's mostly been existing money that's powered it along. I mean, incredible statistics this year. People have an undimmed desire to buy young racehorses.
And what's so fascinating about this is we're not just seeing the established powers of the flat clashing, but this is also often, as you allude to, the place we see the emerging powerhouses making their stamp. You alluded to the fact that we've already had several significant sales this year. What have we seen so far? Lots of money being sloshed about?
Yeah, I mean, as ever, an incredibly strong top end.
Yeah.
So these people, either fired by their own desire or indeed, you know, tax incentives or whatever, spending loads and loads of money on horses at a time when we're over here going, God, things aren't great. We're worried about everything.
Yeah.
But what's sort of caught people by surprise a little bit is the strength further down as well. It's not like, you know, you've had the people spending huge sums at the top and then everything drops away. There's actually been strong interest all the way down. And I spoke with Anthony Bromley earlier in the year about an unrelated subject. We got round to talking about the sales. Anthony Bromley, lean and bloodstock agent, bought Havana Hurricane, for example, this year. And he said that he had noticed the strength in the market, so at all levels. So that will be interesting to see how that carries on.
Which is really significant, of course, because you know, one of the big stories of recent years has been that massive disparity between the top end and the bottom end. And indeed fears that the implications for lots of smaller breeders are pretty dire. And this sort of feeds into the size of the foal crop in Britain. And we'll flash up a graphic on screen now, which shows both initially how the foal crop has already declined, but also how predictions over the following years will see it plunge even further. This has caused real concerns that what we're going to see happening is a lack of supply for these sales, not at the top end, but actually in the levels below that, which then in turn sustains the fixture list. How big a concern is that?
Well, it has to be, isn't it? I mean, the numbers are all going the wrong way. Breeding racehorses is an expensive and not particularly rewarding business most of the time. You know, you read the good stories, but a lot of the time people are dug out by one horse. They'll have however many horses go to the sales and they get dug out by one horse that makes lots of money. So the fact that the sales is operating at lots of levels hopefully gives people cash to go back in. But, you know, you're not going to be surprised that it's not about just what's happening in the sales ring. It's the whole structure, isn't it? People need to be incentivized to breed horses because they're going to be rewarded in the sales ring. But they also need to have people buying the horses, and the people buying the horses are going to want to be able to have runners on the racecourse where they're being rewarded and well treated.
Indeed.
And have a bet, of course, on their horses, which is a slightly adjacent matter, but that's it. So if you're buying a horse for £4 million, it's a slightly different game. But if you're in that mid-market, the whole structure has to work. And that's why those numbers are as worth bearing in mind as the numbers we'll see this week.
Certainly. And final word on this. You are, as I say, a sales ring regular. Give us your favourite memory, give it a sense of the theatre or drama or indeed humour you might see on the sales ring.
Well, I mean, the auctioneers are very good at tats. It's different because you have to bid to the auctioneer at tats. You don't have bid spotters.
Yeah.
So there's always a lot of dialogue between the auctioneers and the clients. Lots of people waving their hands and then quickly putting their hands in their pocket. Yeah. They're trying to catch somebody's attention across the ring. Don't want to do that. My sister was a bidder, as an 8-year-old, was a bidder on a horse because she stood in the bidder's area doing this with her catalogue and they were taking bids off her. Fortunately, the person bidding against her had more money than she did, which is encouraging.
Yeah.
That was good.
Probably quite a lot more money.
Yes, well, indeed. As wealthy as my sister is, even at 8 years old.
You know,
people hiding in odd places, people peering out from behind pillars and disappearing, all sorts of stuff. At this cell, they tend to have a rostrum outside as well. The online element, there's people sitting in the ring bidding online, trying to catch people out. There's all sorts of chicanery going on in that
great
sense.
Stuff.
It is
fascinating, isn't
and it?
And
it is theatre. It is, particularly when you get those big lots and it's packed.
Clive Washburn's outburst, that was a good one.
Yes.
Yeah, show me the money. Yeah. that was a good one.
Well, we will be giving it really comprehensive coverage this week. We're going to have a live blog on both digital platforms and, of course, our team led by sales editor James Thomas reporting from the ground. James does a tremendous job of capturing some of that theatre to do follow along as the week unfolds. We're going to move on now. We're going to talk about the latest smoke signals from the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, on gambling taxes. Lewis, we got basically confirmation last week that she is going to raise taxes on gambling in the budget. I don't think anyone's particularly surprised by that. You know, we all know about the big budget black hole that she's going to have to fill. There's been enormous speculation around what sort of taxes might rise, and I think it's fair to say gambling is a pretty soft target. But what happens on December 26th, that's a crucial thing. What do we think? What do we think currently is the likely outcome?
Well, it surprised no one to hear Rachel Reeves saying that the gambling industry would have to pay its fair share. But on the flip side, she did acknowledge the significant contribution of the industry. So maybe did that hint more towards a more modest rise rather than the stringent calls that, say, Gordon Brown and some of the think tanks have wanted. So it didn't shed much light onto what might happen. But trying to gain any positives, I think the fact she did acknowledge the contribution the industry makes, and Baroness Twycross, she was quite...
The gambling minister, gambling, yeah.
She was quite vocal in the impact it could have forcing people to the black market and things like that. And I think anything that potentially forces people to the black market is quite a rank bad look for the government. And I do think that is something as an industry in the next month and a half we need to really keep pressing to the ministers that it's a lose-lose when people go over to the black market. It's bad for racing, but it's also they're not paying taxes, and it's all right taxing more of a yield that's going down. So I think it's still very mixed messages, Tom. I mean, I the more I read, the more I think they are really going to gun for the casinos and things like that. I think that's where they think they can make most of the money and have a bigger impact, and maybe a modest rise for sports betting is one. I do not feel like racing will be ring fenced from other sports. I think it will be a collective, but it might be a modest rise. But we've got to be careful, because anything that impacts the bookmakers will ultimately have an impact on us in some way, because we're intrinsically linked to them through.
And on that point, just to interject, I mean, Stella David, the chief executive of Entain, she spoke with the Times yesterday.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, if you come after us with tax rises, then we will close betting shops. Yeah. We employ 14,000 people in this country. Like, it's just a reality. So,
and then that's straight off the bottom line for racing, because every single betting shop, 6,000 in the UK, contributes tens of thousands of pounds directly to the sport via media, right? So if that betting shop estate reduces, the impact for racing is immediate. It's not even indirect, i.e. via falling levy. Yeah. So that's the sort of stakes for racing, but also the stakes here for punters as well, because, you know, ultimately, and 'twas ever thus, it's the consumer who ends up paying these taxes. You know, Entain and Flutter and the rest of them aren't going to sit there and go, oh, well,
oh, the bookmakers have been averse.
That's
about
our profit margin reduced. Yeah. They will pass it on. They'll reduce offers. They'll reduce, increase the margin, i.e. provide poorer odds. Mm-hmm. You know, and the net impact is to make betting a less financially rewarding, but also less attractive pastime.
Well, quite, yeah. I mean, the bookmakers haven't hidden this.
Yeah.
It's not like the taxes will pass and then all the punters will be like, oh, hang on a second, we're not getting...
I think some people, though, think they're crying. You know, it's like they would say that, wouldn't they? The boy who cried wolf and everything.
Well, there's an element of that. And look, before you know, policies are put forward, it's lobbying. You're going to have to do it, and you're going to have to come hard for your position. That's what racing's done.
Yeah.
They didn't shut down for a day for the crack. They did it because they needed to be firm and put the position across. So that's the preamble to this. But you know, the messaging has been very consistent from the bookmakers in terms of what will happen. We know the black market has grown because of the affordability saga that continues. So it's not a case of saying all of these things.
And they have no overheads, they have no tax, you know, they don't have the regulatory burden. So they are able to go out and offer massive sort of bonuses and stuff. Now, whether you actually get paid those bonuses is another matter, but yeah, well, it's superficially very attractive.
Exactly, and you know, go back to last year and Lee Motta did an undercover piece with an alleged WhatsApp bookie.
Yeah,
you know?
Convicted WhatsApp bookie. Yeah.
So you know that, we know that this happens, and that's just one guy doing it himself.
Well, we will find out on November 26th when Rachel Reeves delivers her budget. In the meantime, we'll continue to cover this story, its implications for racing, and indeed seek to amplify the voices of punters, who I think are, as so often, the forgotten cohort in all of this. But to move on to happier matters, we are at that glorious point of the year where the flat, gracefully exit stage left, and the jumps in all its muddy, chaotic glory come storming in from stage right. Chepstow, big meeting this week. Whether that is the start of the jumps is probably depends on your personal views, because there's no clear start of the jumps. Maybe we'll come to that. But indisputably, we are on the cusp of national hunt racing, Lewis. What are you most looking forward to?
I do enjoy that Chepstow meeting. I think it's a good starter. I've heard a lot of names like Derham and Nichols preparing decent teams for this meeting. So it will crank up a gear. I mean, personally, a horse I'm looking forward to this season would be Haiti Colours of Rebecca Curtis's. I think that is a horse from maybe a so-called smaller yard that has a potential to go a long way this season. So it's just seeing those familiar horses from last season come back is, it's a great feel. Whether they need to make more of definitively when this season starts is an interesting topic, but we've got to remember that they have been racing since May the 1st. So, So until you start.
But then there's a start of the season, and then there's a start of the
season. You say that, but Sean's Bowen's wrapping up the title now, and that counts for
that. But isn't that evidence of the problem, though? You know, it's like most people haven't paid any attention to it. No offence to Newton Abbott, who do a great job, and other summer jumps venues, but it's sort of like equating pre-season friendlies with the Premier League.
Maybe, but you see the people like the Bowens, they don't exist without the summer jumps. Yeah. It's an important part of the whole ecosystem, and I'm sure James Owens is quite happy. He just won the inaugural summer jumps title. So they're important for these businesses, but it's... You can't.
But important for the businesses, is it important for the sport, you know?
You can't just suddenly say, oh, it's... You can't suddenly say, oh, the jump season started when it's been going for a few months. And that is where it does get confused slightly. Yeah.
David Jennings wrote about this in his column last week, calling for a proper launch to the jump season, said it should start at Cheltenham. It should be the October meeting, but maybe bring it a bit forward and do it with a bit of razzmatazz, make it a big thing of it. What do we think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, these dates that are imposed, a bit like how we've cut off portions of the flat season to fit. Does it really work? I don't know. I can kind of get it. And I can kind of you're building a structure for people to understand a bit better. I don't know. I think during the summer you focus on good racing, and then when it gets to the winter you focus on slow horses. That's how it works, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but it doesn't mean you don't change anything, does it?
No, I think in this case it's fine.
I'm not against any form of like innovation. I think that's, and Dave made some good points, but we can't always look at Cheltenham. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're going to do it, work with this Chepstow meeting that's already there. The point is that the festival in March has become so big, to expect those horses to be out in October is just unrealistic. That's just not the way it works, because we're all guilty as a wider sport for elevating the festival to such a peak that everyone is obsessed with it. So, but I don't think you know, trying to go to Cheltenham again as a season starter or a big hoo-ha is necessarily the right things. We need to encourage other tracks to innovate and maybe be get up to that level.
We'll be coming back to the jumps in full gusto in the coming weeks, obviously. What's the big question that you're interesting you this season, Lewis?
Over jumps.
Jumps.
Yeah, can Dan do it, I guess? Yeah. Can he find a way to hold Mullins off? He's tried to go out from the traps fast. That hasn't worked. Mm. He's tried to consolidate in other areas. It's not quite worked. It's going to be taking him on in at the big festivals. That's where it's going to be won or lost, as it is every season. As we saw at Aintree, just completely turned on its head last season. He has got the new lion, the champion hurdle, that's important. Has he yet got the mass of grade one horses to challenge Mullins? I can see it maybe going the same way again, but that's the big talking point. Can he finally sort of fulfil his dream and hold Mullins at bay?
I mean, he's doing an unbelievable job. I mean, Mullins is just extraordinary. And what happened at the Spring Festivals, particularly Aintree, was hard to imagine. Pete, what about you? Away from the Dan Willie question, what are you most looking forward to?
Will 30p off a pint of Guinness turn Cheltenham around?
What do you think?
I don't know whether that policy in and of itself will, but the general moves by Cheltenham to try.
We had a great letter the other day from someone saying even if you drink 10 pints a day, it's only like £15. But I love the spirit of a Jumps fan. 10 pints a day, 4 days of Cheltenham.
That's your measure. That's your measure. How it works. So in a year where on the whole, racecourse attendance has been very positive. Yeah. And has been good. Good vibes, for want of a better term, around that. Whether Cheltenham, under new leadership, can cut into that and make it work. I mean, even initiatives that they've done where they've brought this overseas membership in that David Jennings again wrote about last week.
Yeah.
You know, they are trying Cheltenham, and we all know that Cheltenham has to work. I mean, Cheltenham as a whole, but particularly the festival, and I know Lewis, that's not to dismiss Lewis's point. He's right in terms of how big it has become for the sport, but if Cheltenham doesn't work financially and in terms of its appeal, then the sport's fighting with one hand tied behind its back. So whether it builds up and there's enough competitiveness on the course, enough people through the gates, and enough people able to bet on what's going on is crucial to what happens.
Final word, will Cheltenham Festival crowds be higher this year than they were last year? Or next year, rather?
Will they be higher?
Don't think
after
too
the
hard.
Budget and all that sort of stuff. They will be a little tiny bit higher.
There we go. Bold predictions.
That's your front page at the end of the week. It was a little bit better, lads.
There we go. We have to end it there. We're out of time. We have had a whistle stop tour through all the big stories in racing. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you very much to my two panellists for their expert insights. We will be back next week with more news and views on the front page. In the meantime, stay tuned to all the Racing Post channels as we bring you the latest in horse racing. Until then, goodbye.